Well, our text today begins much like an ancient epic, a great story. Jacob's father, Isaac, takes him aside. He blesses him, he charges him, and he's sending him on a journey. And Jacob's objective is to find his mother's brother and to obtain a wife from one of his daughters. The camera's on Jacob. We know this promised one who's going to come, who's going to destroy the works of Satan, the serpent, who's going to restore rule, who's going to restore creation, who's going to do away with death. This one is coming, and that's in a seed that is currently in the lineage of Jacob. So our camera's on Jacob, and we're following him through the story. And as we begin this story, and he journeys out, when we get to verse 11 of chapter 28, he's visited by the Lord in a dream. And in this dream, the Lord declares that that national line that his father Isaac was promising him, the Lord is saying, well, no, I'm telling you, I'm giving it to you. Your father has blessed you, but I'm confirming it by saying, look, the national line's coming through you. I'm going to make you into a great nation of people, and the blessing is going to come through you. All the families of the earth will be blessed from the one that comes through you, and you are going to inherit the land that I promised to your father Isaac, that I promised to his father. So this lineage we're following that started with Abraham, which was passed to Isaac, is now passed to Jacob, and God confirms it in a dream. What is this dream all about? What's really going on here in the text? If you remember, in chapter 11, when we first started dealing with nations, the Lord had he told the people to disperse, to fill the earth, to inhabit it. And instead, they created a city nation by the name of Babel. And in that city nation, they purposed to create a tower. And this tower was to bridge the gap between heaven and earth. It was to be the means by which the people mediated between the surrounding people and the gods. The peoples of the earth would have to come to Babel, and then through this tower they have built, they would mediate between God and man. Now we see that they didn't quite make it, because in the story of Babel, God has to come down to see what on earth they're doing. Their tower doesn't exactly reach to heaven, and he's not pleased with their means. He ends up scattering the people. He confuses their language so that they dispersed. But after God's judgment on Babel, and in fact, in contrast to this nation, God raises up a man, one man. He picks him out of the Gentile nations, Abram. This is Genesis chapter 12. God makes a covenant with this one man. He's going to tell him, he's going to make him into a nation, and through him, he will rule and bless the nations of the earth. So, not Babel, but the nation that's coming through Abraham. That he's going to be the mediator. This promise of a mediator is repeated to Jacob in his dream. God is in heaven. Jacob is on earth. There is a ladder in between, and angels are ascending and descending on this ladder. So it reaches all the way to the top, unlike Babel. It makes it. It connects. And God is interacting with man, with his messengers, on this ladder. Now, Jacob's response is interesting to this revelation. He didn't know that God was in this place. He arises properly in fear. We come to expect that at this point. Anytime someone has an encounter really with God, even John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, when he comes across Jesus in Revelation, he falls down like a dead man. I mean, there's awesomeness. I mean, it is fear-inspiring. So he's afraid. How awesome is this place? But then look what Jacob does. He makes a deal, so to speak, with God, a conditional vow. He says, he sets up a pillar and makes a vow saying, verse 20, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and I return to my father's house in safety, if all of these conditions are met, then he'll be my God. If you do all these things for me, then you can have my worship. And we are reminded, in case we have forgotten, Jacob has some serious control issues in the story. We saw some control issues with Abraham in the beginning. He sees famine in the land, so he determines, well, I'm going to go to the Gentiles because the land that God has sent me to can't sustain me. And we see that same kind of thought pattern in Jacob's father, Isaac, but Jacob is going to take this to a whole new level. He has some serious control issues. We saw it last chapter when he was promised to be the nation that God was going to work through before he was even born. The blessing was coming to Jacob because God had sovereignly declared it. But, regardless of that, he preys on the weakness of his brother Esau. He knows Esau is really a fleshly kind of individual. And one particular day when Esau comes home and he's hungry from hunting, he convinces him to sell him his birthright for a pot of stew. He manipulates him to, he usurps this birthright that he cares about that he knows his brother really doesn't regard. He's controlling the situation even though God has already given it to him. And then his father, he's old in age, he's about to die, but he's going to bless Esau. And under the counsel of his mother, Jacob decides to deceive his father in order to get that blessing as well. Because if he doesn't act, he doesn't think the Lord is going to do it. Okay, he thinks, God helps those that help themselves. I need to get to it. So we see that he has this is a serious defect in him. And the Lord's going to have to work this defect out of him before he gets him to the place he wants him to be. He has to break him of this habit. And the Lord has a very interesting way of doing that, we'll see as we follow this story. But nonetheless here, Jacob makes a vow to God, and it's a conditional vow. He's made a covenant, really, between him and God. If God does this, he has to follow through or else. Now, God sends Jacob to his mother's brother, Laban. But the thing we'll find out about Laban is, as controlling and tricky as Jacob is, Laban is his superior. Jacob meets his match in Laban. And God shows his humor and his irony in dealing with a particular flaw in this individual with that very same flaw. So when we get to chapter 29, we see he finds Laban. He desires to marry his youngest daughter, Rachel. And they strike a deal. Rachel is beautiful to Jacob. And Laban says, I will let you marry Rachel. It's better that you marry her than a pagan marry her. So you can marry her because you're in the family, but in exchange you work for me for 7 years. Jacob says, great. That's great. No problem. I'll work for you for 7 years, probably thinking by that time Esau may have forgotten that I kind of stole his blessing, and then me and my new wife can go back home to my father Isaac. He agrees. But when we get to verses 21 through 30, we find that Laban doesn't honor his agreement. Read it with me. Jacob says to Laban, this is at the end of the 7 years, give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her. Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. And now, in the evening, he took his daughter Leah, this is the eldest daughter, and brought her to Jacob. And Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, what is this that you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me? But Laban said, oh, it's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week for this one, and we'll give you the other also for the service which you shall serve me for another 7 years. And Jacob did so and completed her week, and he gave him his daughter Rachel also as his wife, as well as his maid, Bilhah, to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban another 7 years. So now we have Jacob, who had tricked his father into giving him his eldest brother's birthright by coming to his father in his weakness when he cannot see, in a situation where Laban is, instead of giving him the younger sister, is giving him the older sister who he agreed with, because he doesn't see. We have the situation reversed right in Jacob's face. He says, no, this isn't what I signed up for. But Laban says, no, it's not our practice. I'm sorry, work for me another 7 years. And he's stuck. Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, do not be deceived, for God is not mocked. That which a man soweth, that he shall also reap. Not something kind of like that. The exact thing a man sows, that shall he also reap. It's an eternal principle. You know it everywhere in life. If you sow wheat, you get wheat. If you sow strawberries, you get strawberries. You don't put a seed in the ground and wait and say, wonder what we're going to get this season. What you start investing in, that's what's going to come back. We see it again and again through the biblical story. You see it, we were speaking today in Sunday school. Ahab and Jezebel. They kill an individual by the name of Naboth for his vineyard. And the dogs licked up Naboth's blood in that location. So the Lord sends a prophet to Ahab and says, you've done wrong. I'm going to judge you for this. And in the same place the dogs licked up Naboth's blood, they're going to lick up your blood. The exact same thing is going to happen to you. What he sows, he's going to reap. You see the same thing with Paul. Where do we find Paul? In Acts chapter 7, verse 58, you're going to find Paul standing with a group of individuals about to stone Stephen, the believer. And he's holding their garments and encouraging them as they go and stone Stephen, the believer. Paul comes to faith. Is he going to get by with it? No, he doesn't get by with it. 7 chapters later, Paul gets stoned and dragged out of the city. Left for dead. What you sow, you're going to reap. You find it again and again in the story. So Jacob has deceived his father in stealing a blessing. Now he is deceived and has to take a curse. Or at least is not given that which he had made an agreement for. He is deceived and receives the raw end of the deal. So he has 2 wives. And each one has been given a maid by their father. And as the story continues in the end of chapter 29 through about the middle of chapter 30, we have a competition arising between these 2 ladies. And they're having lots of kids. Leah's going to have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. And Rachel's maid is going to have Dan and Naphtali. Leah's maid is going to have Gad and Asher, and Rachel will have Joseph at this point in the story. So we have 11 sons. Now, for those of you who've been following the story, we're saying, wow, why is the Lord giving us all these names, right? Up to this point, we follow one name of an individual, right? So-and-so begat so-and-so. They had other sons and daughters, but we're not really interested in them. Now, we did get the name of Ishmael, right? Because he was the firstborn. He was the child of works, not the child of the 2:24 marriage. So the Lord was showing us that. We also got the name of Esau. Remember, he was born at the same time as Jacob. They were twins. And the Lord's saying, we're not following the oldest. Put the camera on the youngest. The seed is coming through the youngest. But all of a sudden, we're getting all these names. There's even a daughter thrown in there, Dinah. So something different is happening here for the first time in the story. And we're left to say, wow, who are we? Who are we following at this point? Which of these children should I be watching and expecting to carry the 3:15 seed? Who's it going to be? Well, the question we have to ask is, who is the 2:24 wife at this point? 2:24 wife is Leah. The seed has to come through Leah. And as we follow the story, unless we're given new information, who do we follow? We follow the first son. So the camera is on Reuben, the firstborn from his first wife. That's where we're watching for the seed of the woman to come at this point in the story, unless we're given other information. Now, we know that Rachel also bore other children, and we know that their names are given too, so the author's going to give us some reason for that. We're expecting an accounting for that in the story, because the pattern has been broken. Now, When we come to chapter 30, and we're going to find out about that next week, by the way, but when we come to chapter 30, by the time you get to the 25th verse, Joseph is trying to terminate his employment now. He's got his wives, he's got his kids, he's done his time, and now it's time to go, right? He's got to get back to his homeland. He's supposed to go back to Isaac's house. He's supposed to just get a wife. Now he's got two wives, and really two maids that are wives as well. He's got to get back home. But Laban's not ready to let him go. And Laban's going to entice him for more riches. If you work for me, now I'll pay you wages. Name them. Because Laban is no dummy. Laban has figured out that the Lord is blessing Jacob. And as long as Jacob's around, guess who else is getting blessed? Laban's getting blessed too. So he says, no, don't leave. You name your price. You can stay with me. So Jacob says, okay. And he tries to manipulate Laban. And he comes up with a plan. And his plan is to separate the flocks, to separate the goats and the lambs that have stripes and spots on them. He says, that'll be my wages. Whatever lambs come out with stripes and spots, you give those to me. Whatever ones are clean and pure, those are yours. And he's going to try to manipulate Laban, and this is really a ridiculous plan. So, of course, Laban concedes to it. And Jacob, trying to really hedge his bets and cause these animals to produce in spotted and striped fashions, he comes up with a plan. He takes these rods and he starts etching little stripes in the rods, these little almond rods, so that you have bark and then you have little white stripes in it. And he puts them in front of the sheep whenever they mate. He says, if they're looking at these rods when they're mating, they're going to come out spotted. And then I'll have more flock than Laban will have. And I'll grow rich off of Laban. It's a brilliant plan. It can't fail, right? Now, I don't think any of y'all are going to go home and try to do this with your cattle, are you? Because it's ridiculous. It is a ridiculous plan, and there's no way it should have any chance to work except for the fact that Jacob is God's man. Now, remember, we mentioned this last week. I'll mention it again. When we're looking at a narrative story, okay, we have to be very careful when we're pulling out application from a narrative. Because, as you know, you're not Jacob, right? If you go and do this, you will fail. You will not be able to acquire someone else's cattle or sheep or goats by putting little almond rods in it. It's not going to work out for you. You know that God is not working behind the scenes for you. Now, it is true that God is at work in spite of our efforts, right? We know that God is ultimately behind the scenes. So my ministry, I don't have anything that I haven't received from God. So why am I acting like I'm going to take credit for it? Whether it's my good looks, my intelligence, my skill or ability, my finances. You don't have anything that God hasn't given to you. So really, we can't take credit, right? But we don't expect that in our manipulation or control of the situation, it's going to work out well for us just because we're Christian. So we got to be careful when we're making these applications. But nonetheless, in Jacob's instance, for some reason, even though he's trying to manipulate Laban, the Lord seems to make him succeed. Why? Why is the Lord feeding into this issue for Jacob? Why is he making him succeed even though he's trying to manipulate Laban? Why is he causing him to prosper? Do you remember last week when we were looking at Isaac and the Lord wanted Isaac to not go to Egypt? He said, no, you better not leave this land. Go back to the land that I gave to you. And he lingers around the Gentile nations, right? He's hanging out with Abimelech. You know, we're friends, dude, what's up, right? Until something starts to happen with Isaac. He starts to become prosperous. In fact, more prosperous than Abimelech. And their relationship becomes strained. So he has to depart. He has to end that friendship and start to move away from the Gentile lands, right? But then he can't just stop wherever he wants because he has a vast amount of servants and flocks. And he's going to have to water them. And every time he tries to dig a well, the Philistines pop up and they say, this is our well, not your well. And Isaac says, okay. And he moves to the next point, digs a new well. And before you know it, God has corralled him back to the place that he wants him. Through his own volition, Isaac wants to move, but God's working behind the scenes. Jacob needs to go back home. He can't dilly-dally forever with Laban. And the Lord is about to make him move. And the way he's going to make him move is similar to Isaac. Step one, he's going to cause him to become prosperous. So he is blessing this. And as we look, when we come to chapter 31, the first five verses we see, now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons saying, Jacob has taken away all of our father, all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father, he has made all his wealth. Jacob saw that the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, I see your father's attitude, and it's not friendly towards me, not as it was formerly. But the God of my father has been with me. He said, it's time to go, right? I've worn out my welcome here because I've been successful. The Lord has blessed me. I can't stay here. I've got to get. So he does. He picks up and he gets. In fact, he hightails it without even telling Laban. He just goes. So what does this cause? Well, it causes a problem for Laban because one of Jacob's wives, Rachel, steals even some of Laban's idols. Laban is a pagan. So not only is his chief worker his source of income, and his daughters and grandchildren, not only have they suddenly up and disappeared, but he's also even had some of his gods stolen from him. So what's he going to do? Well, he's going to chase him down. He's not going to let Jacob get away with this, right? But something very interesting happens. It's one of those strange verses, and you say, what is going on in the text? Why is this here? Notice, when you look at verse 24 of chapter 31, Laban is chasing down Jacob, and God comes to him in a dream and says, be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad. He says, I know you're chasing him down to do him harm. Don't. But don't you dare do him good either. Why? Why does the Lord say that to Laban? What's going on in our story at this point? Well, we have to remember, where is Laban sitting? He's not obviously in God's seat. He's not in Jacob's seat. What seat is he going to be in? He's with the nations. He's supposed to be ruled and blessed by Jacob. It is not Laban's place to subdue Jacob. It is not Laban's place to bless Jacob. The blessings flow down in the order that God has established. And God is reminding him, this is not your position. That's Jacob's position. So don't bless him. Don't say anything good to him. You don't speak anything bad to him. Laban says, okay. And he goes and he does it. And he settles account with Jacob. And they formally part. He goes, he says, why'd you do this? Why'd you steal my idols? But he can't find his idols because Rachel has hidden them. Jacob gets mad with him. They argue. They set up a pillar and they depart. They say, well, I won't do you harm. You don't do me harm. Let's not go past this pillar anymore. Let's make a covenant together. Jacob agrees, continues on towards his land. But he has one more problem. He thinks he's overcome Laban. The Lord's been with him. He's going back home to Isaac. But now there's Esau. He's in the land now. There's no going back. He can't go back to Laban at this point. Right? The tensions have been strained. Laban came and he made a covenant with Laban. He can't run away from Esau back to Laban and say, I changed my mind. That's what just happened. And now he's stuck in the land. And he sends his servants to go to Esau and say, what's going on? Jacob's back in the land. And what do the servants return and tell him? That Esau is coming. And notice he is coming with 400 men. Look at chapter 32, verse 6. The messengers that Jacob sent out return to Jacob. We came to your brother Esau. He's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. So he's stuck in the land. He's got nowhere to go. Esau's coming to meet him, and 400 men are not an envoy. 400 men are an army. So now Jacob's in a situation, and he's running out of resources to control it. He's reaching his end. So what's he going to do? Well, he has a few strategies. He still has some tricks up his sleeve. Step one, divide the people that's come with him into two companies. Why? Well, he's going to send them across the river and think, well, if Esau slaughters one, maybe I can escape with the other one and he'll think that he's killed me. But I'll live. But he realizes it's not a very good plan. Don't think it's going to work. And he finds himself on his knees before the Lord. For the first time in our story, broken before the Lord. And look at his plea. Chapter 32, verse 9. O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you've shown your servant. With my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers of my children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. He appeals to God based on God's promises. And he waits. And the next day is coming near. He's almost out of tricks, so he decides, what am I going to do? I don't know if God has heard me. I don't know if God's going to respond positively towards me. Maybe I can win my brother over through gifts. So he sends envoy after envoy after envoy of gifts. And then he's going to line his wives behind the envoy. And then he's going to follow up the rear. And hopefully, by the time he gets to him, Esau's wrath will be appeased. So he sets his final plan in motion, sends everyone across the river, and he's left for the remainder of the night by himself. No more resources, no more tricks, no more way out. And it's at this point we have that interesting scene. We've talked about it before. Jacob is assaulted by some unknown assailant in the night. He's alone, he's got no help, and he's attacked. And he wrestles and he struggles with this man hour after hour as the dawn is coming near. Jacob won't relent. The man won't relent. But when it gets to dawn, the man reveals something. That he's not a man at all. And that he could have ended that fight anytime he wanted to by just going boop and knocking Jacob's hip right out of place. Jacob's not struggling anymore. And instead of trying to get this man off him and get away from this man, now he's clutched to him. And he won't let the man go because he knows. He knows who the man is and he wants the man's blessing. The man's saying, let me go. Jacob says, I will not let you go. Because he realizes that this is a visible manifestation of his entire life and his entire attitude towards God. God is trying to get him to go one way through his own efforts. He is trying to resist. And God asks him the pivotal question, the question that's going to call him all the way back to the beginning with his father. He's going to say, what is your name? What is your name? Who is asking me this question? Who is asking me for my blessing? Are you Jacob? Is this Esau? Jacob says, Jacob, it's me. I'm Jacob. I'm the usurper. I'm the heel grabber. I'm the broken one now, and I'm asking you for your blessing. And it's at this point, and it's at this point that God names him, you shall no longer be named Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men, but prevailed. This is why we have the sons of Israel from this point of the story on. He is Israel now. And Jacob asks, please tell me your name. But this one says, why is it that you ask my name? Are you blind? Are you still blind? Kind of like Jesus in his conversation with the Pharisees. They say, are we blind too? He says, because you say that you see, your blindness remains. Because you think you know what it takes to accomplish the righteousness of God through your works, your blindness remains. Because you say that I am not the Christ when I stand before you, you say I am not He, your blindness remains. Jacob's not blind anymore. Jacob knows who he's talking to. He's talking to pre-incarnate Christ. So he names him, and Jacob, the next morning, rises up. He still has a limp. For the rest of his days, he's going to have a limp. He goes across the water, and it's the moment of truth. Esau's coming one way or another. This is either the end of him, or the Lord's going to bless him like he said. And of course, to his surprise, chapter 33, Esau meets him with joy. He accepts him in. He says, "Brother, I have plenty. I don't need your stuff. I'm overjoyed to see you. The Lord has prospered me too. Welcome to the land." In fact, Esau tries to get Jacob to go with him. "Why don't you come back home with me? Come to Seir. Let's dwell together." He can't dwell with him. He can't dwell with him because he has the inheritance, right? He can't go to Seir. The land is his own. So he puts him off. He travels to Shechem instead. And it's there he erects this altar. And it's this that's going to launch the rest of our story as far as Israel goes. This altar and this piece of land, it is the second piece of land that these individuals own in the story. Remember, Abraham bought a plot of land to bury his wife. Now Jacob is buying a plot of land to magnify God's name. He's going to build an altar on this land. Verse 20 of chapter 33, he's going to erect it. It's going to be called El Elohi Israel. God, the God of Israel. And it's from this point on he's going to associate himself as the God of Israel. "I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Israel." Now, we mentioned when we started this story that if we're going to look for the context of this and say, how can I understand what's happening here? Why am I following Jacob? What's going on in his life? If this isn't just business principles or principles for how to live a good life, how can I understand it? We're saying to understand any place in this story, whether it's Genesis chapter 30, whether it's Joshua, Judges, Ruth, you got to go back to Genesis, particularly Genesis chapter 1, chapter 3, chapter 12. You got to go back to the beginning of the story. And when you do, you find God's the main character and you're given the tools to follow the story. But when I think about my story, or you think about your story, your life that you're living today, where do we need to go to get the context for our story? It's going to be the same place. If you want the context for your story, what's going on today in your reality, you go to Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 3, Genesis chapter 12, and on through the story. But you start at the beginning, and you realize the main character in your story is God too. Because your story, just like Jacob's story, is a part of his story. Right? This is history. This is reality. Okay? We live in a very special point in time. We know that the Messiah has come, but we're in between his coming from the first time and his return. We have a very special privilege of, one, having the Holy Spirit, and two, having the opportunity to talk about the one who did come. Not hope for the one who will come, but look at the one who did come. And we know that all of us who do have that hope, the next thing for you is resurrection. That's where your story is going. You're going to the same place you are here, a similar life today, serving with the Lord on planet Earth in glorified bodies. It all comes down to if you know the one who did come. Is that part of your story? It's not about your works. It's not about what you do. You go look at an orphanage and you see two people caring for children. It's not the works that determine it. By your words, you will be justified, and by your words, you will be condemned. It matters if he is part of your story. When you stand before the Lord, what are you going to say? "I got nothing. I know Jesus," right? "I know your son. That's all I got." And I hope that's your anchor, certainly my anchor, and I hope all your hope is the resurrection to come. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.